Hi, this is Paul, and the Distributist has a channel on YouTube, and I've spoken with him once, and he tagged me in this video on Twitter, and after I watched it, I told him I was going to call him the Disruptivist, because it's this, he does some stuff in his videos that really gets in my head, and has me thinking in new ways, and so he's a you know, I really appreciate his insight, whether I agree or disagree with him. He really gets me thinking in some different ways. And he did this video on Mencius Moldbug, who I didn't really know anything about, but it's someone that many who watch my channel will probably know something about. I was pretty early on, people told me that this was a channel I should watch. And the main question was, why does the left always win? And, you know, the right side of history and all of this. And his video is about an hour and 15 minutes long. So for those of you who watch my videos, it's not a very long video. But why does the left always win? And I thought, well, and then he kept talking about it. And he talked about basically conservative drift towards the left, how Taft is more conservative than Ben Shapiro, and on and on and on. He goes over that through history. And now notice 1518, I could have used 1517, we'll get there in a minute. But, and the more I thought about this, I thought, boy, he's got a point. And it's always, it's, you know, Peterson talks about the fact that when you have to change an idea, it's painful, because a little something in your head dies, and you never like that death. And so, you know, we always want everyone and everything to validate us and affirm us and agree with us. And so when you find something that makes a good point and you have to admit it, it's like, oh, crap, that's a good point. And yeah, there's issues with it, but it's a good point. And then you have the question of, well, what is left and right? And I just finished watching a John Anderson video that also caught my attention. I hope there's a chance I might talk with John Anderson. Yeah, that's something coming up. I've got some plans in the works for things, and that should be on video. But defining the left, and the guy who John Anderson was talking to made the point that this left and right came from the French court, where the progressives sat on the left and the conservatives sat on the right for the king, and this has carried on through history. And I always kind of wondered where this left and right comes from. But of course, this whole premise, why does the left always win? And like certainly during my lifetime, I've seen a lot of that, even though politically we tend to swing back and forth. This kind of social progressivism keeps marching steadily onward and seems to get win after win after win. Now, I've got some yeah buts about that. For example, prohibition. But maybe that's even an example of the left. Well, we'll get there. So I've got a lot I could say about that, but I don't want that distracting me, because there's a real point in here that he really made. And so, yeah, he's the disruptivist, and he disrupts my head, and he bothers me, and I kind of like being bothered in that way, and I don't. And so what exactly is the left? And so it's hard to define, and we know it when we see it, and he talks quite a bit about that, and it's a good video. You should watch the whole thing. And he talks about, you know, this was part of the reason when people kind of disrupt you is because they make points that you already agree on, and then they make new points, and they're... And, you know, one of the things I've always said is that the Republicans and the Democrats, they're not that far apart on many ways. Now, there are obviously some defining issues that they use as wedge issues against each other. And again, I don't generally like talking a lot of politics in my videos, but I'll hazard it for this one. And he talked about the social structure of George Orwell's 1984. You have the inner party and the outer party. And he made the point that the Democrats and Republicans, the White House and the power swings back and forth, but the entire swinging is kind of continuing to march left. And so the Republicans are kind of loyal opposition, and the Distributist point is that, you know, you can't really look to them to carry the day for you. And other conservatives that I listen to, like Rod Dreher, has made similar points. And many, many times over the years, I've voted third party because I can't stand either party. And sometimes, yeah, they're the same in many ways. And then he makes the point that left drift is cultural entropy. And, oh, here's another colonized my head. You know, the mug doesn't get put back together. And so, okay. And yeah, all right. And you know, we're seeing this in a sense in terms of arcs of civilization. And that's a favorite way of looking. When does the American civilization hit its decline? When does the British civilization hit its decline? When does the Roman Empire hit its decline? And, you know, those are big, big arcs that go over many, many centuries sometimes. And how can we judge, and can we judge from in the middle, and what does that mean, especially when we all have our own little arcs, which are our lives. And then he said, well, you know, maybe one way to frame it is, I don't know that he said maybe, was righteousness and lawlessness. Now, I haven't posted the last couple of weeks. I have to get busy with that. But in my adult Sunday school class, I'm going through 1 John, and 1 John is a very black and white book, and so we're dealing with that in the Sunday school class. But this righteousness and lawlessness is a theme in the New Testament. And there's the man of lawlessness that arises in the book of 1 Corinthians. And Jesus' theme in the Sermon on the Mount is righteousness. And before, I've made the point that Dallas Willard in The Divine Conspiracy really helped me connect up Jesus' talks on righteousness with Plato and his Republic and righteousness, and this theme of the ancient world of righteousness and what it is versus lawlessness. And this is external in terms of the rule of law and law in a society, but it's primarily internal. And I just finished my sermon, Jesus Has a Punchable Face, that's going up today. Today is Friday the 8th, Friday, February 8th. And so that rough draft for Sunday video is going up today. And I talk about the fact that, you know, you have to have an internal law inside of you. And this internal law helps you say no to certain kinds of temptations that will be damaging to you. And these things scale all the way out to society. I watch people complain about corruption in the United States, and certainly there's corruption here, but it's not like it was in a place like, for example, the Dominican Republic or many, many other countries of the world. This corruption is, you know, it has to be found in individuals, and that's why, in a sense, the argument that a democracy cannot live with you know, if you don't have a population with its own internal sense of morality and right and wrong and resistance against corruption and all of those issues. And so, you know, gosh, he made a good point with this one too, in terms of righteousness versus lawlessness. And I had to say, yeah. Now, again, I can go into a bunch of yeah buts, and there's ways that we can talk about that, but it's a good point, and it's an important point. And so, yes to that one too. I mean, he's carrying me along through his arguments, and he's begrudgingly dragging me into them. It's the relaxation of the inner law. And this was a key thing in that video too, that I'd seen some articles this week, and I'd kind of been thinking about it, but when he said it in this video, I saw it. And the relaxation of inner law is afforded by technology. And so you actually have kind of an internal heart corruption entropy, which is supported and fueled and encouraged by the ongoing march of technology, that things that in the past, let's say, a young woman would have to be very careful about her selection of sexual partners because of the risk of pregnancy, but now with reliable, affordable, sometimes free contraception, you know, there's very little risk of getting pregnant. And so, well, then she can have sexual license. But the further we go down that road, the more we realize, oh, but the risk of pregnancy was only one risk. And in fact, there's a vast, rich, deep, metaphysical, metaphorical reality that these old laws inhabited. And now, as technology affords us, you know, why watch my weight and what I eat when I can control blood pressure and cholesterol with drugs? Why go to the gym if I could get my my physical fitness in a drug, why should I go to the hard work of getting a gym? If I can get my spiritual experience by taking a psychedelic, why go to the hard work of years of spiritual and religious discipline? There's this way in which technology continues to enable us and afford us the easy wins. And so you can kind of see the corrupting nature of technological progress. And if you start to pull all of these things together in a society, his point about leftward drift, oh man, I hate it when someone else is right and I gotta rethink myself, and little cherished ideas and norms in my head have to die. In Christianity, it kind of sets you up for this, because there's a thing called mortification, where parts of us have to die so that Christ can become alive. And so, ugh. And then the question, of course, which this one's easy, because this one, fear grabs hold of us and motivates us. Will the center hold? Is it all one big long slide down the slippery slope to chaos and or tyranny and or destruction and the death of our civilization, which all of us know that, well, at least Christians believe that civilizations all tumble, and there's only one kingdom that will finally last, and that is the kingdom of the Son of Man. But of course, I'm an American too, and I don't want to see the chaos and the breaking down of the achieved order that I enjoy in here early 21st century affluent America. I love the freedoms I possess. I love the comforts I receive. I love all of this stuff. But then, of course, there's the opposition that says, well, it's a brave new world, and maybe Ray Kurzweil is right, and we'll offload our... I don't really think we will, because, again, the more we discuss... If you also watch Verveke and the cognitive science stuff, the idea that we'll just simply offload ourselves into a computer, well, the problem wasn't so much our limitation in computing power, the problem was our ignorance of ourselves, which is what we keep bumping into. But, of course, the eschatological promise of the religion of technology is that we will always find a fix for what ails us. But that then pushes the question again. It's back onto us. What is a human being? What exactly is flourishing? And then he said, and then the distributist or the disruptivist said a trigger word for me, which is salvation. And if you're in my Sunday school class and you start using that word lightly, I will jump on you, because what, and that doesn't mean I'll be mean to you. I'll just say, I'll define that word for me, because saved from what? Or even more importantly and more difficult, saved for what? And who is we? And, you know, he makes the point that, well, we'll be saved by technology. Well, the we in that are our, you know, are those cyborg ancestors who are half machine, half human beings? Because you can't have these conversations without asking the question of telos. Renovation from the inside out, but towards what point? To what point? You need these guiding stars in order to be able to orient us. Now, one young man who grew up in a different country and is in the United States doing graduate studies, a fairly oppressive country. I'm not going to name it because I don't want to risk any, you know, I don't want to risk anything. But ask the question at our meetup: what is a utopia? How would we define utopia? And you know, the point that he was making is that there's all of our little moral decisions are orienting us and pointing us towards some type of utopia or some type of endgame that we imagine in our head. We think we know what the good is that we're pointing to. We think we know what salvation is. And so if you're a conservative and you look at this leftward drift, you say, oh, it's corruption. While many people are cheering and saying, oh, it's improvement. So you've got Steven Pinker on one side, and you've got, you know, the disruptivist on the other side. And, you know, here we go back and forth. And a lot of the question is, well, what is good? Saved for what? Saved from what? Who is we? What is utopia? What is truly good? Is it in our meetup, you know, we talked about flow states, and you know, we often do some discussing of my videos, but usually discussing of what other topics come in. But you know, if we could put a helmet on with magnets in to get our brain into flow state so that we can properly function, or if we can, you know, if we can somehow shed our bodies and be free, you know, in some sense, I'm continuing to read through Michael Pollan's book. Well, I'm enjoying that book. It's a good book. You see that people ask me for favorite books, and it's such a hard question for me because I often love the book I'm most stuck on right now. I fall in love with books, and then, oh, that was a wonderful book. And then I'm on to the next book. And so what's my favorite book? It's probably the last book I really loved. So, you know, enjoying Michael Pollan's book. What a gifted author, and really appreciating his voice and his ability to write. And so anyway, see, I distract myself. But how do we know the good? You know, maybe just take some drug and take Soma. You've got Brave New World. And so the individual raised the utopian question. He had just finished reading Brave New World. And I thought, yeah, that book will get into your head. But what stars do we navigate? And to me, this gets back to the Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson conversation, because Sam said, well, well-being. Well, we have a sense of well-being. And from what I could perceive from Sam Harris, he thought that that sense of well-being just kind of scales. And what I get a sense of is that this A-B testing, that this thing is better than that thing, and a comfortable shoe is better than a shoe that pinches, and a meal that tastes good is better than a meal that doesn't taste good, and a relationship that feels good is better than a relationship that doesn't feel good. And Jordan Peterson, via Piaget, pushes back with a devastating argument about the equilibrated state, that in fact this goodness not only has to scale for me and my neighbor and all the way out to everyone in humanity, but also has to scale for me and future me and my descendants, but also my ancestors. And so, you know, Piaget, I like many of you, had introduction to a little bit of developmental psychology in college and Piaget, but I'd love to see Peterson recommend a book about Piaget and his quest to resolve the science religion debate, because that was the first time I'd ever heard that, and I heard it from Peterson, and he talks about this equilibrated state, and you very much get the sense of, well, this is really a handle on something like the kingdom of God or something like goodness. And Peterson again and again points that, you know, you need reference points, and my point is that you really need reference points outside of the iron box of secularism, and that's why religion is so fundamentally important, because you can actually look back in time through history, and why concepts of revelation are important, because they get metaphysical, and you need something that big to enable to orient it, because this kind of A-B testing. Jonathan Merritt had a tweet about, you know, well, he was kind of riffing on Cohen Marie. Cohen Marie hits Netflix. My wife had done a Cohen Marie thing in the house about a year ago, and it made me grumpy because, oh, she's thrown away all the stuff. She wants to throw away some of my stuff, and she wants to change the house. And so I was getting grumpy, because usually if it's a good thing that I know it's a good thing and I don't want to go along, I get grumpy because, you know, I love my comforts and my pet sins and my self-indulgences. But, you know, she organized her closet, and her closet looked great. And before you know it, I thought, I'm going to do that to my closet, because I want my closet to look like hers. So I went through my wardrobe and whatever. And boy, that spark joy thing just really annoyed me. It's like, oh, spark joy. The curmudgeon doesn't like that. But okay, I went through my wardrobe, and whatever didn't spark joy, I got rid of. And I got rid of all kinds of crappy stuff that was, yeah, too old. And I'm not a fancy dresser. Y'all can see that. But in the end, it was a good thing. And, you know, doggone it. And that's the way it often is. My poor wife, you know, she'll start down some road and I'll drag my feet and grumble, and she'll get annoyed with me, and then we'll have a little spat, and, you know, and I'll back off, and then, you know, sometimes she'll be proven right, and then I'll have to say those most awful words in marriage. You were right. I was wrong. some words that you can't live without in a marriage. But, you know, so, but this, you know, this A-B testing in the short run, Jonathan Merritt makes the point that you should, you know, give up any, throw out any theological system that doesn't spark joy. That's quite frankly a bad idea, because most of the truths, the really important truths in my life, are truths that doesn't give me the sense of sparking joy. They're things that I begrudgingly have to admit to or relinquish to. You know, C.S. Lewis calls himself the world's, you know, England's most, how did he say it, reluctant convert. And so often, you know, this is part of the reason I associate with this label Calvinism, identify with it, is because so often Jesus has to pull me kicking and screaming and I don't want to go, and dang it, Jesus is so strong and yeah. But so it is. And so, yeah, if I could do all my morality testing, A-B testing, well, actually, that's a really bad way to judge morality. And the real challenge is to work this equilibrated state idea to see what ideas are better and right for the long term. Someone in the meetup had seen some article somewhere that said that the German people were their happiest during the 30s and 40s, which of course came at the expense of the Jews and the Slavs and everybody else in Europe, and then became their more miserable. And then I haven't posted this conversation, but I had a conversation with a young man from Germany, and he was telling me how, you know, Germany's in kind of a mess because their identity in the 20th century, you know, they're the pariahs of the world, which means that they can be guilted into almost anything. And you see that dynamic in individuals and what happens when a whole nation takes that on. And, you know, on one hand, it might look like Christianity because it looks like generosity, but generosity motivated by the wrong things does not yield good fruit. And so, you know, all this stuff is enormously complex. Our little A-B testing about goodness and sparking joy and morality, that really can't get you there. So the distributist is a conservative Roman Catholic, and so he says, well, what's the start of this? The Protestant Reformation. And I get his point. You know, the rebels break the law and the church and the institute for their new cathedral, as he says in the video. And there's a good point. But now, you know, I'll kvetch at a bunch of things and I'll hold it to myself. But when we get to this point, I can't hold back, because the righteousness versus lawlessness, that's a very nuanced, subtle, complicated dynamic. And you could make the point of Paul, who lays aside, in fact, that's exactly the point the Judaizers make with Paul. You're setting aside circumcision. You're setting aside dietary laws. And for the Gentiles, perhaps as, where did I make that point? I guess I made it probably in the sermon that I just did the rough draft for. You know, one, just as Jordan Peterson observes via Nietzsche that the discipline of Catholicism in the West, you know, honed the European spirit and strengthened it. You can make a similar argument that the discipline of resisting polytheism in the Old Testament, resisting the Baals, resisting Molech, resisting the gods of Babylon, resisting the gods of Egypt, that this in the Jewish people over centuries made them strong and durable so that they wouldn't assimilate. You know, in some ways, the world's most stubborn culture, they wouldn't assimilate. And what that has for the most brought them over centuries is pain and hatred. But they held together that way, and they remained themselves that way. And so you might argue that Jesus, You know, this is exactly the point of Jesus' culture war. Jesus, you're soft on Roman sex trade of young Jewish girls. Jesus, you're soft on fasting. Why aren't your disciples fasting? Well, when the bridegroom is there, they don't, you know, the party doesn't fast. And Jesus, although those things could be excuses for holding the line against the corruption that the Romans are bringing to our society. So, yeah, I see the point on the Protestant Reformation, but one could make similar points on Jesus and Paul. And there's a sense in which the fight against lawlessness becomes legalism. And as I think it was Tertullian said, you know, on one side you fall off the horse on the antinomian side, on the other side the legalist side. So there are issues with this whole argument, but there's real value in this argument, and there's insight to be gained by thinking through this argument and wrestling with this argument. For most good arguments, they are things that you really have to live with. And they're like, you know, not really a little angel or a devil on your shoulder, but they're like a little personality in the back of your head, and you'll run along in life and you see something and that person says, Yep, that's my point. And so the consciousness committee tries to keep you honest via those kinds of things. Bonhoeffer, you know, again, books, Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship. And if you've never read Bonhoeffer's Cost of, if you've never any Bonhoeffer, read Bonhoeffer, so many good authors. But Bonhoeffer, of course, was part of the German elite that didn't go along with Hitler. And was part of a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler, and paid for his participation in that in a German prison, and was eventually executed before the end of the war. But you know, he was one of these outliers who wouldn't go along, and you know, lived an interesting life, and someone who could have escaped Germany. You know, he had access, he had money, he had status. He could have escaped Germany, but he stayed, and he stayed at the cost of his life. And he writes in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, which warns against cheap grace. And so here in Christianity, you're always dealing with how to deal with the law. And so people ask about, what's the difference between Lutheranism and Calvinism? Well, Calvin brought up, both Luther and Calvin would be horrified that we have those two labels today, by the way, so maybe I should stop using Calvinism as a label. But, you know, Calvin said, we have the, you know, Luther had this stark antithesis between law and grace, and given Luther's story, you can have that. Calvin is a second generation reformer. He says, well, he comes up with a third use of the law. The law is to, you know, the use of the law by civil magistrates to keep order, that's fair. But the third use of the law is now we can express gratitude. And so those of you, if you watch my rough draft for Sunday, see misery, deliverance, gratitude. We use the law to express our gratitude to God, because in a sense, the law does in fact reflect God's desires. But now we don't use the law as a way of saving ourselves. So if you look at the Heidelberg Catechism, the treatment of the Ten Commandments comes in the gratitude portion. This is how we as Christians live the Christian life. And this is how Calvin tries to, you know, kind of pull back from Luther. But one of the big issues throughout Christianity in the West, now I know the Orthodox the Orthodox come in to say, yeah, if you'd listen to us, you wouldn't have these problems with grace and law and some of those things. And maybe I'll have those conversations when I talk to my friend Luke Thompson from Twitter one of these days. But we're always dealing with this question of faithfulness and lawlessness, or righteousness and lawlessness. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Tim Keller, and Tim Keller, better than most, persuasively argues that for Tim Keller, you can find Veritas Forum. You Google or you search it on YouTube, you'll find it, Tim Keller Homosexuality, and watch the whole conversation that Tim does in a Veritas Forum debate, where they really try to corner poor Tim on some of this stuff, and Tim will basically make the point, it's self-righteousness that gets you damned. well, what do you mean by that? And actually, that's very existentialist. Tim Keller is a big fan of Kierkegaard. I know Esther doesn't seem to like Tim Keller near as much as I do, nor Kierkegaard, but Julian will like that. Those of you who don't pay much attention to the comments, these are all folks that I've met since I've started this crazy, wonderful journey into YouTube land. But so you have this question of, well, how does this all work? And this continues to be a live debate and part of big part of the conversation in Western Christianity. What is the relationship between righteousness and lawlessness, and where are the inflection points? And that's why this is all as hard. So then you have the cycles of civilization. Rome descends into chaos, and the church in monasticism grows a new Humpty Dumpty over 1,000 years. But you might argue that, from 500 to 1500, roughly the Middle Ages, is that a heyday of Christianity? And does then Protestant Reformation provoke the next descent, which we're 500 years into? So is the cycles kind of Western civilization, or is it certain nations, the rise and fall of France, the rise and fall of Britain, the rise and fall of the Dutch Empire, the rise and fall of the American Empire? Now, our poets prophesy zombies and a dystopian future where once again inner strength offers communal competitive advantage. If you watch The Walking Dead or any other dystopian futuristic things, so often the inner conflicts, must I put my life at risk to avoid killing, or shall I kill instantly? I mean, these things hover around various dystopian future apocalyptic movies because that's really where it engages. And again, it's the question of inner strength or inner righteousness and the risk. And part of a point that I make often in terms of my messages are that this is exactly where the resurrection comes in, because by virtue of the resurrection, if you believe in that, you believe that in fact that kind of risk is warranted. And in fact, Jesus models it and demands it. Jesus says, you don't believe in life after death? I'll go first. You don't believe in resurrection? I'll go first. And you might say, well, yeah, but that was Jesus. And it's like, yeah, but did anybody rise from the dead before him? He had to have faith too, to go to the cross and be beaten and be crucified and wear the mocking spittle of his enemies. Say, well, I don't believe in the resurrection. Well, okay, what options does that leave for you? Your well-being at the expense of your enemies, your political tribe's well-being at the bloodshed of your political adversaries. That's where that goes. And what the resurrection affords is to do what Jesus does, where in the garden, when he's being arrested and Peter pulls a sword and cuts off the ear of the high priest, and Jesus says, oh no, and he heals the ear. And in a sense, what Jesus says is, if there's going to be any bloodshed, shed my blood first. Who says that? That doesn't make the resurrection a cheap trick. It makes the resurrection a promise. So you've got these arcs of civilization. So is it Western Christendom that the Protestant Reformation is now corrupting? Is it the American Empire that's going to fall? And will we, in a sense, will the ecology collapse? Or will it's ironic because those on the left right now are fearing ecological collapse, and those on the right are fearing moral collapse. And I would say, yeah, probably both. Probably everything. I'm this weird combination of sort of a cortical, as Jonathan Haidt calls the cortical lottery, a cortical lottery winner. So I'm by nature rather happy and optimistic, but I've been born into one of the most dour religious traditions possible, Calvinism. You're all depraved. But yet, Calvinist dour pessimism is in the midst of this glorious Christian optimism. Christianity is the original divine comedy. The Bible is the original divine comedy. And I talked about that in my sister's eulogy that you can find on this page. And I talked about that in my father's eulogy that you can find on my YouTube site. That's way before I started doing this stuff, or my aunt's eulogy that I posted. I don't have a lot of confidence in technology because our track record with technology is it gives and takes away. And technology, especially in this frame that the distributist and Mencius Moldbug show, is that technology is an enabler of, in the sense, our internal destruction. Isn't that interesting? And it makes perfect sense. Of course we're going to make things to make sinning possible. Of course we're going to make things to that make our ease possible, and that ease will make us soft, and we're going to be all in those chairs on Wall-E floating around. Of course technology brings us this way. It also gives us many things, and I want medical technology. So here we are. The different time arcs, I just talked about that. Let me not see the collapse of my culture. Let my kids not see the collapse of their country. Let the ice shelf in Antarctica not fall so that I have to see Florida go under. But all civilizations fall. And again, I'm a Christian, so God's kingdom will come. And it's sort of an apocalyptic parental control steps in, and the eschaton begins. But now we have to ask the question, which story governs? And we're back to the worldview choices menu here. Are you postmodern? There is no story. And this is why I think progressive liberationism might just be natural religion, and that's entropy. That's the slide left. That's where this all goes. We keep looking for the liberation to be freed from the necessity of self-control. And Drew Dyke, who is an author, and he's up in Portland, and I follow him on Twitter, and he was on the Phil Vischer Sky Jatani podcast a number of times, and I only kind of know him through Twitter, but just recently wrote a book on self-control, and I haven't read it yet. I haven't even bought it. Maybe I will. I don't know. I'm about to say something to get me in trouble, but that type of Christian book, I can usually just kind of page through quickly. Yeah, good point. Just good points. Maybe it's a great book. I don't know. I think Drew's a great guy. I love what he does on Twitter, but. Maybe that is in fact the slide that technology and entropy and we're just releasing ourselves some self-control until everything falls away because we can't manage life in this world without self-control. And the most, in a sense, the most wonderful of all political situations, democracy can't exist without self-control. And then we're just going to have these cycles of tyranny that we fall into, and maybe we'll be happy and say, yeah, I was fortunate enough to have lived in the United States at the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st century, and I only began to saw the to see the decline. But it's helpful to read history too, because what you find is that many times in many places we're on the edge. And 1930s America was on the edge, and 1950s America was on other edges, and we're always on the edge one way or another, and that's why I talk about the age of decay. Life is not stable. Life in this world is not stable, and it never has been, and I don't think it ever will be, because again, one of how this video, the distributist video, really helped me see was this relationship between this drift left and technology, and how these two things are combined, and how that scales out. And I don't have all my language on that, but it's in my head, and my consciousness committee is working on it, so I'm sure it'll leak out in more videos to come. But that's a real thing. And the point that he made in that video, you colonized me, baby. You colonized me. But now we're back to which story governs. Is it postmodernity? If Postmodernity is basically just chaos and power in worldview. And that doesn't go anywhere good. And because it scales back down into us, and it makes me want to say, why don't I just give in to all of my internal desires? Why don't I give in, and why be faithful to a wife? Why be faithful to a lord? Why be faithful to a religious tradition? Why be kind to people on the street? Why not Just indulge myself. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you die. And you've got axial eschatology, so, you know, I'm working through Verveke and his stuff, and, you know, and he's right in that all of these systems, they're axial, and there's a dynamic when, by which, if you can identify the development of something in history, in a sense, you demythologize it, and you de-enchant it. And, you know, kind of learning about the Axial Revolution, I can feel that having that impact on me, and I have to think through those issues. A lot to think about. The endless cycles of palingenesis, which was something like Hinduism. You know, you ask some Hindus, well, why if everything is this one great sea of oneness and perfection, it devolves into the chaos, and then it goes back into the sea, and it goes back into chaos, and so you have this perpetual chaos and order swinging back and forth. I mean, a number of Eastern worldviews play on these issues, and so you have Russian Doll, which again I mentioned and recommended on Netflix. Do you seek resolution and escape, but then escape into what? And again, I'll prefer my actual age, axial age eschatology. And if you push me, I'll say, can you imagine what life of the age to come is like? And I say, no, I can't. That's because I see all kinds of issues. Will the order get suffocating? Will there not be enough chaos? What does it mean that there isn't any sea? And so then I look to smarter, wiser people like C.S. Lewis and his book, The Last Battle, and I think about those things. But finally, again, I think at what's at the heart of Calvinism is finally trust. And I say, you know what, Lord, my brain isn't big enough. The amount of books that I can read and the amount of things that I can see in my one little short life, it ain't big enough. And I'll never know it all, and I'll never see it at all, and I'll always be biased, and I'll always be petty, and I'll always be wrestling with my own desires and urges, and I'll always get stuff wrong, and I'll never be loving enough, and I will never make it. So I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to believe that you are as good as you say you are, and I'm going to believe that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, and I'm going to believe that he walked out of that tomb, and I'm going to believe that this affords me the joyful yet suffering path of faithfulness and love in my relationships around me, even if the world is going to hell in a handbag. And someone made a comment in my conversation with Alistair, you know, how Alistair and I both, you know, when Jordan Peterson gets too mired in politics, we start to grumble. And someone said, yeah, but that's because you're living in a, you know, you think of a few best men. You can't handle the truth. There's people that stand on a wall that buy your comfort and buy your freedoms at the cost of their blood. And that's right. And that's a good point. That's an important point. And how do you know that if you weren't in the prison camp that you wouldn't be just like, look at Tim Keller telling the story of Eric Little at the end of Tim Keller's talk at Princeton Seminary, where, and I've mentioned this in other videos before, where Eric Little, you know, all the other priests and religious leaders and missionaries in that camp were just as cutthroat as everyone else. And Eric Little shone like the sun. And you'll find those stories coming out of concentration camps where everyone, again, that's the Walking Dead. It's the zombie apocalypse. Everyone gets petty and selfish and self-interested. My well-being at the expense of everyone else. And someone there will be a saint. And they will give their life for the others. And they won't do it, you know, just we're so moment fixated. There's one grand gesture in which it's given. No, they'll do it slowly, bit by bit, like Jesus. Jesus dodges death again and again. And they tried to kill him, and they tried to stone him, and not Jesus, not my time. Jesus, to be a saint does not mean being a doormat or a wallflower. To be a saint means you do exercise judgment. You do exercise agency. You do say no to people. But sainthood, you learn to do it in a way that it's always for love. And it's always finally for the welfare, not just simply the little A-B welfare that so often, You know, that's what happens. Little Siddhartha Shears from the sermon I preached last week, you know, well, my daughter doesn't know sin. Oh, your daughter knows plenty of sin, honey. Just show her the word. She's probably going to become like your parents. You know, when the beggar on the street asks you for a dollar, do you give him the dollar? There's AB. You know, I give him the dollar. Why do I give him the dollar? To get him off my back. You know, I dealt with this all the time in the Dominican Republic. You come out from someplace and some kid pops up. I watched your car. All right, you watched my car. Do I give you a few pesos just because it's expedient? Do I give you a few pesos because you're a poor kid? You're just trying to survive and there's no way you can. Or do I give you a few pesos just to get you off my back? So you do the AB morality and they say, yeah, but if you encourage that kind of behavior, it scales. Boom, 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 boom. And so, well, I need someone to follow in this stuff. And so I follow Jesus. Well, what would Jesus do? Well, it's a really hard question. It's not little AB morality. It scales all the way out. And if I were the one in Eric Little's prison camp, would I be just like one of those other missionaries? Maybe I would. You know, it's hard to say. But the point is that it's misery, deliverance, gratitude, and I'm finally saved by grace, not saved by my performance. And I would hope I would have the kind of gratitude to not fail my master. Even though I know often I don't have the kind of gratitude because I do fail my master. So which story governs? The option you embrace impacts the way you navigate your little cycle. I don't think A-B testing on goodness or wellness, Sam, is going to get you very far. POMO, which is basically chaos and worldview, eat, drink, and be merry. Palingenesia, karma? No, it's too law. It's too law. Renovation of heaven and earth. Costly love is the right side of history. That's what the resurrection says. It requires inner strength, which actually preserves society. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. It affords you release from self-salvationism, tribal pressure for righteous compliance, and virtue. Because here's the thing with, and Tim Keller makes these points better than just about anybody I know. Here's the thing about self-righteousness. Here's the thing about the law. If I achieve in complying with the law, I have now exercised the inner strength to possess that, and I can look down at all of those people that don't have it. And one of the things that we know is that this business about having inner strength is not just, I mean, there's two competing frames of human beings. One is that we have no agency, that we're just playing out the bad things that happened to us as a child or the good things that happened to us as a child. So the strong do well and the weak do poorly. And therefore there is no agency and you can't hold anyone accountable. Or the other vision is that it's all agency and by free will and sheer determination. I had my wife had an aunt who in the 1980s when crack was going on used to brag because she'd say, you know, they say that once you take that first hit of crack, you're addicted. I'm pretty strong-willed. I think I could take crack. And the idea of watching Aunt Ruth take crack, that tempted me mightily. I thought, it wouldn't be too hard to, places I live, it's not too hard to get some crack. Give it to Aunt Ruth. She never would smoke it because, of course, but she just wanted to make that point that she would, if she smoked crack, she wouldn't become addicted. And I thought, you sure are a big believer in your will. And the irony was that she's passed now. But she had a hard life. And that's the thing. And so those two worldviews of we have no agency or we're all agency. Oh, we're a mixture and we're a mess. But you can't give up agency, but you can't give up understanding. And so that's the problem with the law is that even if it's inside, well, I alone. No, but then you're a Pharisee. Then you're that's not really fair to the Pharisees. Then you're a legalist. Then you look down on others. And so I think Tim Keller is exactly right that the real way to understand it is you're saved by grace, which means that I can't look down on those who are weak because I'm weak. But I can't live without I need the third use of the law. Again, that's why I'm a Calvinist. I need the third use of the law. I need to I it's at the end of Saving Private Ryan. I've used this before where Private Ryan is there and Tom Hanks and his squad have given up their life to fulfill this order, which maybe is kind of a crazy and stupid order. And Tom Hanks' dying last words to this young man are, "Earn it." And he wants to live his life living up to the great sacrifice. And I think that's one view into the Christian life. We live our lives trying to live up to that great sacrifice, and we know we never will. But it's so beautiful, and it's so right, and it's so noble, and it all comes together that I say, how do I want to live? I want to live like him. And he says, live like me and die like me, and you will live again, and we'll go further up and further in. And why be a Christian? Because I don't think there's any more beautiful way to live. It's why I do it. Someone asked me in an email, and if you're still listening to my videos, you're still sending me emails. Why do you believe in God? I believe in God because I've always believed in God. I was raised believing in God. We only jettison beliefs when we have sufficient beliefs to get rid of the old ones. That doesn't answer why I'm a Christian. For most of human history, most people have believed in God, and the world was a mess. Just having people believe in God doesn't prove much of anything, so the book of James says. Seeing the beauty of Christ that will change your heart, that you decide, I'll willingly suffer, I'll willingly sacrifice parts of me for the other, you don't do it because the other is beautiful. You realize that doing it makes the other beautiful, and you realize doing it, you run towards the goal. That's what the Apostle Paul says. So, why does the left always win? I don't know. Why does the age of decay always win? But resurrection. So, the disruptivist strikes again. Keep striking, my friend. It's great being wrong in all the right ways.